Now, remember, today's theme is seeing things the right way. How often we get so involved in the details that we lose sight of the big picture. In the midst of the financial meltdown of 2008 and 2009, we were busy looking for a scapegoat to blame. Collectively, we feel that we've got to assign blame and then we can fix the problem and move on. The problem with assigning blame, if we blame, we don't look at ourselves as part of the problem as well. The problem is we've been looking for blame in all the wrong places. Our next guest is going to explain why fixing the blame on Goldman Sachs and the other financial institutions while trusting Congress to write laws for financial regulation is missing the point and may be more harmful than good. Eric Singer is the manager of the Congressional Effect Management, he first published an article on the general effect of Congress on daily stock prices way back in 1992 in Barron's. Since then, the idea has attracted support and evidence from both the financial and the academic community. Mr. Singer has been a financial professional for over 25 years. More recently, he has practiced focusing on raising funds for and investing in small caps public companies. He is a graduate from SUNY, that's the State University of New York at Stony Brook, where he was a Phi Beta Kappa, and then he went on to Cornell Law School, where he was a member of the Law Review. Welcome to the show, Eric Singer.
Thank you.
How are you today?
I'm doing okay. How are you?
Not bad. You're calling us from New York City. So how's the weather back in New York City?
I can't use curse words on the radio. It's hot.
It's hot. It's bloody hot. Well, you should be out here. It is a little bit damp today. We have high humidity in the 80s and a little bit of mist out there, but we're nice and cool here. Wish we could send you some of our cool weather and wish we could import from you some of your hot weather, that's for sure.
Well, look at it this way. It's over 100 degrees, and I think it's over 85% humidity. It's an ugly day.
That's what I would call stinking hot, that's for sure. All right, so let me ask you, let's just jump right into it. I think one of the most disturbing similarities that I've seen recently in our government is the health care reform bill and now the proposed financial reform bill. Both of those were pretty much hurried through Congress. Few legislators have read either bill entirely from cover to cover. And what's your take on the haste with which the administration is pushing the financial reform bill?
Legislate in haste, repent at leisure. I think that Congress is oblivious to the damage they cause when they make these giant bills, and businesses have to figure out, what do I do now? I think one of the most intelligent commentators on the Great Depression is a professor, Robert Higgs, based out in the West Coast, and he pointed out that what really made the Great Depression longer was what he called regime uncertainty. And what he meant by that is, you know, they would try one law to fix an industry, and if that didn't work, they'd try another law to fix an industry, and if that didn't work, they'd try a third law to fix that industry. And every time the industry would have a sense that the rules were going to change, people who had to invest money would back away and just say, you know what? The market's going down. I'm scared. I'm not doing anything until I know what the rules are, and I think that we've touched bottom. And that's the mistake of the Great Depression that we're repeating. We're changing the rules a lot, and when you have it's not just having a 2,200 page bill. It's having a 2,200 page bill that says, and the Secretary Sebelius will review for this particular sub-industry and issue more rules. I think that her name, or the name of the Secretary of Health and Human Services, appears something like 1,800 times in the bill. That's a reservoir of uncertainty that paralyzes everybody, and it's very deflationary and paralyzing to have the government, to know that the government's going to issue more rules before you can really go ahead and figure out what they are and what you're going to do with your business.
Wow, I'll say. And we're talking, everybody, to Eric Singer. A lot of this, though, we've got to find a scapegoat. I mean, it's part of America's personality, is we've got to affix blame. And right away, we chose Goldman Sachs and its leader, Lloyd Blankfein, as the group to assign the blame to. What is your take on that? Was that justified to pick them out as the scapegoat for this? And what are your thoughts now that sort of we've gone through a couple more months of the financial reform?
Well, I think you get an audible sigh out of me. The particular way that they got at Goldman Sachs, which was to announce during the middle of the day that they were going to do a civil investigation of Goldman for fraud, that had never been done before. I mean, it had just never been done before. In the past, even if they had a criminal indictment of a company, they would wait until after the market closed. So that announcement was calculated for maximum damage against Goldman. It seems to me in that case, Goldman was not that case looks to me like it's a horrible case, that it's very flimsy, that there's nothing that Goldman did wrong in that case. That said, the government has been busy favoring Goldman by giving Goldman superior settlement returns as they got with AIG. And also, when the money was given out, the banks turned around and preserved their usual bonus pool, which, you know, in the grand scheme of things, there should have been some moderation on that.
Yeah.
And so I think that the optics are horrible, but I think that the primary bad actor here is the government, and I think that the banks have really just, done what they could do. I mean, Lloyd Blankfein has a job. His job is to make the most money for the shareholders that he can. If the government will give him money, it's his job to take it.
I agree.
So I don't blame Goldman. I blame Congress and the rest of the federal government.
All right, we're talking to Eric Singer, everybody. And if you have a different opinion about Goldman Sachs or about financial reform, you can call us here at 639-0008, 639-0008. We'd welcome any thoughts that you might have on this subject. Well, you mentioned about the midday news release that there was an investigation of Goldman Sachs, and that seemed a little bit odd. I want to drill down a little farther on that, if I can, please. Is this just a sign of the times? Because at the same moment that they were having the press release, the Democratic National Committee purchased Google AdWords, Goldman Sachs, and SEC, and linked both of those AdWords to an article or an advertisement about Wall Street greed. You know, I think that on one hand is very, very creative, but what does that say about the politicalization of this whole issue?
It says horrible stuff about the politicization of this issue.
Such as?
First of all, if you're serious about going after a transgressor, you don't try them in the press. You know, if you want to put a hit on somebody's reputation, you try them in the press. So the thought that the Democrats had been tipped ahead of time and knew that something was coming and were just ready to spring upon it really creates the greatest appearance of impropriety of all, which was that the prosecutor was working hand in glove with the political party just for political effect.
Wow, strong words. Now, you are an attorney. I mean, do you stand by those words?
By training, yeah. I mean, that's the appearance of it. There's just no denying it from a public relations point of view. You know, in the past, the U.S. Attorney's Office, the SEC, they always went out of their way to say, no, there are no we're only interested in justice here. We're only interested in the disinterested application of the laws here. You know, if there are people that are calling for a judge in the Gulf, these oil spill in the Gulf, to be recused because he owns $15,000 worth of oil company stock. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
If that kind of conflict of interest is enough for somebody to argue with a straight face that the judge shouldn't be allowed to handle a case that affects his area and every single person that he knows, how is it that the Democrats benefiting from an SEC prosecution shouldn't be enough to taint that prosecution?
Interesting point.
An impartial listener.
Interesting point. Well, let's look back in history just a little bit to our more recent financial meltdown, and that was right around the turn of the millennium, where we had WorldCom and everything else. Coming out of that, Congress enacted Sarbanes-Oxley. That was the big thing, and it was designed to help have more transparency. However, you know, one would argue that clearly, Sarbanes-Oxley isn't working. Where was Sarbanes-Oxley throughout this entire financial debacle, not only with Goldman Sachs, but with Citi, with Bank of America, and everybody else? You know, what were some of the unintended consequences of Sarbanes-Oxley during our most recent meltdown?
Well, I think, first of all, the proper, you know, the Congress loves to give these laws nicknames, you know, like the Let the Bed Bugs Bite Act and things like that. I think the proper name for the Sarbanes-Oxley law would be, let's lift unemployment from 5% to 10% Act.
Ooh, why do you say that?
And the reason for that is that Sarbanes-Oxley made it much more difficult for a small company to go public. And once that happened, small companies are the ones that create job growth in this country. And job growth stalled basically from the day that law was passed. So we've gone from having 65 or 66% of the U.S. population working to having 58% of the U.S. population working. And one of the reasons, I was a banker that worked raising money for small companies, and after Sarbanes-Oxley passed, a lot of the institutions that I would place deals with called me up and said, Eric, you know, we loved your deals in the past. We loved these small companies in the past. But we're concerned about liquidity now. We're concerned that they're too small. And we're really concerned, you know, it looks like they're going to have to spend $2 million just to comply with Sarbanes-Oxley. And they only have $1 million of profit, so they go from a profit to a loss. I'm sorry, you just can't call us about these companies anymore. And my experience was the same experience for every other banker for small companies.
We're talking
so
to...
We wiped out most of the small companies. You know, 80% of small companies that could have made it got hurt by Sarbanes-Oxley, and all of those companies are the ones that provide employment growth. If you're a large company and you need to grow, you can grow overseas. You can get additional talent from overseas. That's where your growth comes from. So it's just a very ugly, ugly law, and I'm just sorry it wasn't more overturned by the Supreme Court last month.
Well, we're talking to Eric Singer, everybody. He is the author of Financial Reform and the Goldman Sachs Kabuki. Let's spin that idea out just a little bit more, if we can, Eric. Not only did Sarbanes-Oxley prevent a lot of companies from going public, but I think it had a compound effect on the more recent financial problem. And here's how I see it, and I would love your comments on this. When small companies can't go public, that means investors like you and I have no place to put our money, or at least no place traditionally to put our money. We start looking for other investment opportunities, don't we? And since Sarbanes-Oxley was preventing small companies from going public, we didn't have the stock market to be able to do that. We had to start looking at much more exotic financial instruments in order to wring some profit out of our investments. And all of a sudden, that led to all sorts of new investment ideas like collateralized debt instruments that were the crux of the financial meltdown of 2008-2009. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I don't think Sarbanes-Oxley stopped us from investing in the stock market. I think it stopped us from investing in small companies. I do think that the real estate boom was in part caused by such low interest rates that you had to go that first of all, it made real estate appear to be much more valuable than it was, and secondly, it made everybody go on a global hunt for yield, and so those are, I think the real estate meltdown wasn't so much CDOs caused by Sarbanes-Oxley. I think that CDOs were baked into the process when Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac said, "We'll buy your mortgage paper. Relax, don't worry." You have a lot of, you know, they went back in 2007 and did a forensic audit of a mortgage pool from 2007, which had several hundred mortgages in it. They randomly selected 42 to test them for fraud in a forensic audit, and 42 out of 42 applicants committed fraud on their application to get their mortgage.
Ouch.
So if you're at the Bank of America or you're Countrywide, and you know that Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae are going to buy this mortgage piece of paper, you're not going to test that applicant very closely to see whether they're lying or not. You know, just tell them, fill out the forms, you'll get your money, we'll collect our fee, and we'll sell it to them. Well, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, they precipitated this fraud. And this is, in the latest financial regulation law, the law touches every single financial institution in the country except Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac.
And I want to explore that when we come back. We've got to take a short break, Eric. I'm sorry to cut you off there. But I want to delve deeper into that when we come back, because I completely agree with you on this. Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, part of the problem, not part of the solution. But we're going to take a short break. When we come back from the break, we've also got two more tickets to give away to the Santa Barbara Museum of Natural History and the Ty Warner Center. Stay tuned. The call-in number here is 639-0008. We'll be right back after this break.
Attention small business owners. Did you know that you could save hundreds, if not thousands of dollars a month on your business phone costs? You want to know more? Then just pick up the phone and call Access Line Communications. You not only save on service, you can even get a complete phone system for your office at 0% financing. That's just dollars a day. Call 1-888-510-5955 today or visit accessline.com/thecoach. Tell the salesperson that your promo code is The Coach, and you'll get a free Visa gift card with your purchase. Check it out today.
In business today, time is money. So when your office computers or servers go down, so does your income. Locally owned and operated IT The Works will respond quickly and professionally, getting you up and running and making money. IT The Works services include everything from scheduled maintenance to updates to virus removal, backup, and data recovery. There is nothing they can't or won't do to earn your business. If you are frustrated with your current computer services, or if your IT plan has you wondering what you're paying for, give IT The Works a call. They will accurately determine your needs and provide you an affordable service estimate. Making the decision to change is sometimes difficult and overwhelming. With IT The Works, Anthony will create a seamless transition with a personal touch, not often experienced in the IT world. Give Anthony Ellis a call at 479-1605 or visit IT The Works website at ittheworks.com. Once again, that number is 479-1605.
Hi, everybody. This is Coach Ron Tunick, sharing with you my thoughts about a very caring, family-owned business right here in Ventura called DMC Transmissions. Now, I don't know a thing about transmissions. You all know that. But DMC Transmissions knows everything about your transmission. Here's what they know. DMC Transmission knows how to create that very special experience that says we care, we listen, and we're going to get the job right the first time. DMC Transmissions, right there at the corner of Seward and Thompson. Give them a call, 652-2221, 652-2221. Seward and Thompson, say hi to Donnie for me at DMC Transmissions.
And now, back to brainstorming with Billy.
You know, I think your brain produces a chemical that blocks out my voice.
What? Now, here's your host, Billy the Brain.
Welcome back, everybody. This is Billy the Brain, and I have as a very special guest today, Eric Singer. We're talking about financial reform. We're talking about some of the more recent financial crises that we've had here in the United States. If you've got a differing opinion, feel free to call us at 639-0008 and express that opinion. Before we get back to Eric, however, we do have some business to take care of, and that is got two sets of two tickets to the Santa Barbara Museum of Natural History and the Ty Warner Sea Center. Those will go away to the second and third callers at 639-0008, 639-0008. Remember, you can't have won a prize from KKZZ in the last 30 days. Give us a call, 639-0008. Now, Eric, back to you. You have written an article which I thought was just great. It's called Financial Reform and the Goldman Sachs Kabuki. Loved it. And we talked just before we went to break about two of my least favorite institutions right now, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Fannie Mae and Freddie appear to have been at the heart of the mortgage meltdown in the United States. If we take a look at direct cost of government support to Fannie and to Freddie, it's somewhere in the range of $381 billion. That's billion with a B, and there doesn't seem to be any cap in place to prevent spending more money with those two institutions. So my question to you, it's a two-parter. First of all, are Fannie and Freddie necessary? And then why won't legislators tackle the issue of Fannie and Freddie reform in the proposed financial legislation?
Fannie and Freddie are unnecessary. They've saved very, very tiny amounts of money for lenders over the years in exchange for having a monopoly. And, you know, just think about where you go and get your car repair. Would you rather have a choice of two or three or 100 guys to repair your car or one or two? It's not a monopoly in totally enforced, but it's a practical monopoly. So we're better off without them. Just kill them, and let the market celebrate diversity in the market.
Well, let me interrupt you and challenge you on that, Eric, for just a second, because Fannie and Freddie have been around for a long, long time. Isn't it only recently, since 1999, during the, I guess it was the Clinton administration, where we put more emphasis on home ownership and everybody needs to have their own house in order to win, and that's really when Fannie and Freddie jumped to the forefront?
Well, that's you know, that's when it got worse and worse and worse, but it's been getting progressively worse since you know, they were first created. We just don't need them, okay? We're all better off knowing what we actually own, what it's actually worth, what the real price is. And Fannie and Freddie, by having government support, and by the way, they're the most egregious, because they had a wink and a nod government support for years. It was like, you know, they're not officially on the balance sheet of the government, but, you know, we know that Congress will never really let them go under. So don't worry. You should just trade their bonds just like as if they were treasuries. And that happened. We're way better off just with everybody, you know, having multiple sources that they go to and no one having control of that. Period, end of statement. Now, as to why they got the free pass that they did, you know, they gave hundreds of millions of dollars to the politicians over the years, you know, to every member of Congress, to every senator. You know, that they had a superb lobbying effort. And by the way, if you worked for the Federal Reserve and then you got a post as a senior person at Fannie or Freddie, you could then turn around and make tens and tens of millions of dollars.
Wow.
You know, without having been you know, I think that's fabulous government work if you can get it. Think about it. You worked for the Federal Reserve, you then took a senior position at Fannie or Freddie, and then you got paid $10, $20, $30 million. I would do that.
Sweet deal. Yeah, there are lots of people who would sign up for that deal. All right, well, let's talk about the second half of the question is, why aren't legislators willing to tackle the issue of reforming Fannie and Freddie?
They're still getting donations from Fannie and Freddie's lobbyists.
To this day.
You know, I'm a congressman. I have the same time horizon as the Somali pirates. It's 121 days between now and the election. If I'm a Somali pirate, then it takes me 30 days to, you know, get provisions for a raid on a boat, and then I ransom it over the next 90 days. That's a 120-day project. Right now, it's 120 days between now and the election, and if I go after Fannie and Freddie, I'm going to have $100,000 less for the election.
Okay.
I need every dime that, or $10,000 or $50,000. It's a very bizarre system, but we have a lot of congressmen who are partial to entities that support donations to their campaign.
Gotcha. All right. Well, very interesting, and I love that analogy, the Somali pirate time horizon. That's very fun. Let's kick it up a notch. Let's take a look at this thing from a little bit larger picture then. Going back to the financial institutions, and in particular Goldman Sachs, is Goldman Sachs, or really any financial institution, too big to fail? And what would have been the consequences if Goldman or any of the other financial institutions would have gone under, in your opinion?
Well, I think that you have to ask the... What would have been the consequences if if there were not government officials appearing on TV at 3-minute intervals saying, if we don't do this, the whole thing's going to blow. You know, in the last 6 months, CIT went bankrupt. It was a $50 billion bankrupt.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember it?
I do.
Did you hear about it? I mean, half the people on Wall Street don't even remember it. Oh, yeah, I guess CIT did go bankrupt. It was the same order of magnitude as these other things, but it was handled with discretion and appropriateness. I don't want to, as hot as I am on this subject, I don't want to go all the way off the deep end. There was a meltdown. They had to do something. I just think that they did a lot more than they had to, and I think that the lessons that the politicians drew was, this is just so much more power than we ever had before. This feels great. When the right answer is the Jimmy Stewart answer of, oh my gosh, we shouldn't have done that, and we should just back away from exercising this kind of power in the future.
Gotcha.
That's what they should do. There's nobody that's too big to fail, and we need to decentralize this stuff, not to centralize it and tell people, don't worry, whatever you do, we're going to bail you out.
All right. We've got a big shout out to Brenda and to Ashley. You're the winners of the tickets. Congratulations. Thank you for calling in. For those of you who did call in and didn't win, we'll have more to give away tomorrow, so stay tuned to Billy the Brain. Immediately following me, we've got Leading Your Inspired Life with Susan Burrell. There will be no ABC News in between, so we'll go straight to Susan. We've only got just 2 minutes left, Eric. We're talking to Eric Singer, everybody, who is an authority on the financial legislation of financial experts. One final question for you. In the early 2000s, London tried to make a bid to usurp New York as the financial capital of the world. It failed back then. What's going to happen, however, if this new financial legislation passes with regard to where capital will flow? Will London overtake New York as the financial hub of the universe?
I don't know if London's going to overtake, but Switzerland, London, Shanghai, Hong Kong, they're all going to take a bigger bite than they would have. And I'm going to leave you with one final thing, which is, you know, your viewers may not be aware, but I'm the head of a fund called the Congressional Effect Fund. It's a public fund. The symbol is CEFFX. And the way it works is I only invest in the stock market long when Congress is on vacation. So I try to avoid some of the political risk that's out there. And they can find it if they go on the web and look at congressionaleffect.com or CEFFX.
CEFFX. All right. And Congress is on vacation, so are you investing long at this moment?
I'm long today, whether I like it or not. But, you know, that's what I promised people to do. But the fund, you know, the fund is doing well compared to the S&P 500, and they can see its performance when they go on the web and take a look at our performance compared to the S&P.
Love it. Eric Singer, you're a great guest. Thank you so much. You are the author of Financial Reform and the Goldman Sachs Kabuki. Listen to us tomorrow again at 10 o'clock here on KKZZ for Brainstorming with Billy the Brain. We'll see you then.